Thank you very much.
It's now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, newly to Visalia with 6 months of sobriety. Let's give it up for Rita.
Rita. Rita.
Newly to Visalia for 6 months. Let me clarify. Okay?
All
right.
Woo!
I'll let him tell you.
Yeah.
Visalia sober.
What's with all these short people, man? Okay.
You okay right there?
I think so. Can you hear me? I'm sorry. My name is Rita and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 11th of 93. And if you'd have told me on November 10th of 93 that I'd be in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, I'd ask you to share whatever it was you were drinking or smoking with me. But I am here now, and it's where I need to be, and it's where I'm supposed to be. I'm a Bay Area girl, East Bay, actually. I grew up there. And you know, I had a great childhood. I can't say I didn't. You know, I had good parents. I had a good upbringing. But I loved to run with the bad boys and the bad girls. And so when I got into high school, I started thinking that was really the coolest thing in the world to do. So I did. I had my first drink when I was 12 years old. We broke into my parents' liquor cabinet, and my friends made these things called slow gin, if you've ever heard of that. And I proceeded to drink the whole thing and throw up all over my mother's pink carpet with red slow gin, which was wonderful, and pass out. And my friends cleaned that all up. And when I woke up, I was laying in bed, and I had no idea how I'd gotten there, except that I heard my friends saying, "Hi, Mom," which meant my parents were back home. And they came into my room, and according to my friends, I had got the flu and I was real sick. And God bless friends, eh? And so my mother walked in and she hugged me and loved me and all that good stuff that, you know, codependents do. God bless them. And my dad bent over to give me a kiss and he got about 3 inches away from me and said, "We'll talk in the morning." And I went, "Oh, shit." And we did talk in the morning. So there were three things I was told to be afraid of: trucks that are bigger than me, God, and my father. So when he spoke, I listened. And I went on to listen for another 6 years or so, because I didn't pick up a drink again until I was about 16. But once I got it, there was no stopping. It was full on. I'm a child of the 60s. Which means we invented every drink and drug you're using right now. You know, because it was full-fledged where I came from. I was a hippie in the flower child generation. You know, I went to Winterland and a lot of places and passed out on the floor and missed a lot of good music. Ran the streets of San Francisco for a long, long time. And it was fun. It was quite fun for a while. Then I decided I wanted to make some easy money. So I started running things other than liquor, which got me deeper and deeper into that situation. Until one day somebody put a gun to my head because they thought I had shorted them. And that scared the bejesus out of me. And once I convinced them that I had not shorted them, they let me go. And I ran like hell. And hid out for quite a long time. But I never stopped drinking, because when everything was going bad, that was the one thing that made it feel okay. You know, and it put me in a neutral place, real neutral place. I learned that I was a lot better off drinking at home than I was going out, because of that tendency to overdrink and pass out wherever you stood. Wasn't a good idea. So I did a lot of my drinking at home, you know. And as I got older, I would go out with my friends and we'd be having dinner and I'd have like three drinks and go, "Oh, that's all I can do." And they go, "God, you're such a lightweight." And I wasn't about to explain I had seven before I left and I'm going to have seven more when I get home. because that was too long of an explanation to give. So I hit it pretty well. And then I decided that I would get married. Well, let me backtrack here for a minute, actually. I got a job in 1977 working for the railroad. And I proceeded to work that job for the next 40 years of my life. And when I first went there, I was sitting up in a railroad car having lunch. And we used to have these things called call boxes. And they looked something like this box to my left. And I remember a guy walking up there and opening the box and rolling up a J and smoking it as he walked down the line. And I watched this and I thought, I'm here. This is my place. I'm staying here. And I'll tell you, you know, we partied like there was no tomorrow. Every single day that we could. You know, we drank our lunches on Sunday. We drank them most of the time through the week. And everything was great until they decided that they would start drug testing, which really sucked. Ruined the whole buzz. And so we all had to, you know, change our patterns and our minds and our directions. So about that time, I got married, and I had a son. I still hadn't stopped drinking. I just kept on drinking, and I drove drunk with him in the car. I was at home, and I was drunk, and he would be talking to me, and I'd be passing out. Basically, I really wasn't being much of a mother at the time, to say the least. I wouldn't have wanted me for a mother. That was damn sure. He probably had no choice, so... I just kind of kept up with that, you know, for a long, long time. His father decided he had something better down the line, so he went that way and I went the other way, and I proceeded to get married four more times. Funny thing, I kept marrying alcoholics. God, why would I do that? I mean, I kept picking those people. And I just couldn't figure out what was going wrong with these marriages. Needless to say. And so finally, on the fourth one, we went to see a marriage counselor. And she looked at me and she said, he has something to tell you. And I said, okay. And he looked at me and he said, you drink too much. And I blew up like a mother. I blew up. And why I didn't say anything, I don't know. I think I was so stunned I couldn't talk. Because nobody had ever said it directly to my face. They had said it, but not right at me. And I said, wait a minute, you're there with me all the time. What do you mean I drink too much? And he said, well, I know, but I don't want to drink anymore with you. And I went, oh, that's nice, okay. And this woman said, well, I don't know much about this, but I'm going to send you to somebody who does. So she sent us over to this place in Pleasanton, and by where I lived, and this beautiful woman comes walking out. She's about, I guess, 5'6", and she's blonde. She's freaking beautiful. You know, she's got clear skin. She's smiling. I hated her guts. I wasn't going to talk to this woman. No way. You know? Because I'm standing there with long, straight brown hair, and I'm looking like, you know, the cat drugged me through five fights. And, you know, and she's just all, hi. And I'm like, oh, I really don't like this bitch. But I did, for some reason, I listened to her, and she made sense. I was sober enough that she made sense. And she left the room and said she was going to go get something and bring it back. And so my husband at the time said, well, what do you think? And I said, you know what? I'll give up everything, but I'm not giving up cigarettes. Now, why I said that, I have no idea. So we went home, and the next day we went up to Big Sur. Big Sur was my happy place. And we rented a room, and I decided that I'd taken the last of my dope, I'd taken the last bottle of champagne I had, and drank it that night. And in the morning when I woke up, before he got up, I went walking out into the forest, and I sat down on this log. And I just started crying. And I said, okay, dude, it's me and you now. I have no idea what the fuck to do. So please tell me which way to go. Because I'm lost. And that was all I said. And it was almost like one of those movies that you see, you know, where the light comes through the trees. And I think what they call that is 15 seconds of clarity. And it was my 15 seconds. It was the 15 seconds that I let somebody touch me that closely since I was a child. So I went home and I decided I would just stop drinking. No problem. It was no problem. I stopped drinking for 30 days. And on the 30th day, I was at work and I started shaking. And I started crying uncontrollably. And I started losing it big time. And I was waiting on a lady. I was selling tickets at the time. I was waiting on this lady. And we had this thing where you put, you know, the money through the glass kind of thing, like thanks sometimes. And she grabbed my hand and she said, "Sweetheart, I don't know what it's got you, but it's got you by the toes." And I yanked my hand back and I said, "I'm fine. I'm fine." And that woman was blind, mind you. She was blind. She couldn't see me, but she sure the hell could feel me. And so I shut the window when she was done, and I walked in and I shut the door, and I just sat down at the desk, and I just started to put my head down, and I was losing it. What I learned later is that's what they call an emotional breakdown. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced it. I hope not, but if you ever do, you'll know it when it hits, trust me. And so I'm putting my head down on this desk, and it says here in big, bold, black letters, "If you think you need help with drugs or alcohol, please call this number." And I've been sitting at this desk for 5 flipping years, and I never saw that. God, I wonder how that happened. Anyway, there it was, you know. So I thought, well, maybe I need help. Everybody goes telling me this. Maybe I need help. And but I'm still not sure if I'm alcoholic, okay? And so I call up this number, and turns out it's in L.A., and there's a guy that answers the phone. And he says, "Okay, Rudy," he says, "well, I'm going to give you an address, and we want to see you there in 24 hours. And I went, "Oh, no, I can't go in 24 hours. No. I can't do that. I can't do that in 24 hours. And he said, "Well, you don't have much of a choice." He said, "I'll tell you what." He said, "I'll give you 48 at the most. If I don't see you in 48 hours, I'll call you back because I've got your number." And I thought, crap. You know, the guy that invents these things, like, you know, how come they tell you what your number is, right? And so anyway, I got rid of my dog. I was living in a condo that I had, and I gave my son over to his father, and I decided, okay, I'm going to do this thing. And I went down there, and I was finally going to accept this stuff. That, you know, I can go hang out with a bunch of other alcoholic drug people, and everything's going to be cool. They're my people, right? If nothing else, we can find a way to sneak out or whatever. But anyway, so I go down there, and they say, "Well, we're sorry, but your insurance isn't going to let you stay here." And I went, "No, you have to keep me here. You don't understand." And so my whole attitude in 48 hours had shifted. How, I don't know, but it had shifted. And they said, "We're sorry, we can't keep you as an inpatient. You have to be an outpatient." And I went, oh God, I'm going to go get drunk. This isn't going to happen. It's not going to work. Well, somehow, and the only thing I can think of is the grace of somebody that has more brain cells than me and a lot more power than I do, kept me there and kept me coming back. So I would get up at 7, hit the freeway, come home at 4 in the afternoon. By 6 o'clock, I was in a meeting every single day because I was so freaking scared. I didn't know what else to do. And if you'd asked me, I'd never been scared in my life. If you'd asked me. Of course, that was another lie. I had a lot of them lined up. But I was scared. I was real scared. So I did this. I did it. And, Lord, that was a long, long month. Very long month. You know, because when you're an alcoholic like me, and you're left alone at home, and you're alone with yourself, the whole, most worst person I can imagine being with most of the time, at that point, it's the temptations everywhere, you know? I had to change the way I drove home because the bar I went to was on the way onto my house. So I had to drive all the way around the block to go home. My other friend, who I used to stop by and see in the evening, was up the street, and I had to drive around her house and not go by there. And you see these beautiful little signs, these ads, like, you know, like, try goose vodka, and you've never had goose vodka. And you're like, oh, man, that looks... And you're like, oh, crap, I got a test tomorrow. Okay, so go home. So I managed to do this for about 2.5 weeks, and they figured that since I was doing okay, they weren't going to let me stay in this program any longer than 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks, it's amazing the things that you start hearing when your head starts to clear up. Just the fact that you start hearing anything is amazing, to be honest with you. And I started hearing what these people were saying, and I knew 2 weeks wasn't going to cut it. So I wrote this big 3-page letter to the insurance company, and they wrote back saying I could have as long as I needed. So I don't know what it was that I wrote in that other than I was begging them to let me stay, because I knew if they didn't, I would be drunk. And I knew if I kept drinking, I would be dead. And I knew I still had a son to raise, and I knew I still had people that loved me. Why they did, I have no idea to this day, but they did. And so I needed to pay back the favors I had been given and the grace that I had been given. So I finished it up. I stayed about 2 months, and I wrapped it up. And by the grace of God, to this day, I have not had a drink. And if anybody would have told me that this was possible, I would have said they were a liar. Because the things that I've experienced in sobriety, I wouldn't wish on a lot of you. When I was young, I always used to say I was going to live fast and hard and die young and leave a beautiful corpse. Now I'm just going to live old and leave this, whatever that's worth. But it's okay. You know, it's a good thing. And God and I are happy with it. But my son made up for the things that I didn't. And when he was 21 years old, I lost him to this disease. And he died behind a methadone addiction. And I'll tell you, I wouldn't wish that on any mother. If you have your children with you, or even if you don't, cherish every bloody moment you've got. Do not miss a minute of it. If you have a mother, give her all your love, because she needs it as much as you need her. And try not to judge us. We do the best we can with what we have. And there's no more than we can do. And if you're not a parent yet, when you become one, you'll find that's the best you've got. And I was very fortunate to have 21 wonderful years with that child. And in between that, I got a daughter that I adopted. And she's beautiful. And I know I might be a little biased, but don't mind me. I am her mom. But she's in the Navy. She's living in Italy. She's married to a wonderful man, wonderful man. And she's doing quite well. And she's a lot wiser than her mother ever was. In fact, I think she's an alien baby kind of thing, because she got drunk one time in her life when she turned 21. And she called me the next morning, and her words were, and I quote, "Mom, how the fuck did you do this?" and I said, "Very gently, sweetheart, very gently." And she said, "God, this hurts." And I said, "Yes, it does." And now she drinks on occasion, but a glass of wine will last her till the cows come home in the morning. You know what I'm saying? She's nothing like I was. Not a thing. God bless her for that. And she wants me in her life, which I'm very thankful for, because there was a time when neither one of them was very happy with me, so they weren't around too often. And I went this past Christmas, I flew to Italy to see her, because I hadn't seen her in about 4.5 years since she went over. And she came walking into the airport, and the minute I saw her, I just started crying. You know, I just started crying, because here was this beautiful woman that I hadn't seen in so long, that grew up to be a beautiful person. You know, she is, I think, as normal gets. You know, and she is wise, and she is kind, and she is patient. Like I said, she's nothing like her mother. thank God. And I adore her. And she's my blessing. And I miss my son. I miss him something terrible. Because he was one of my very best friends. But I'm going to see him again. I have all the faith in the world in that. Because that's one bond that never changes. Never changes. So, excuse me for that. So, I've been sober for a few days. And I have been so fortunate. And I mean, there's been bad times. I've buried most of my family. I'm not one of the last ones left. They're all gone. I was born very late in my family line, so most of my family is gone. But you know the wonderful thing about this program? No matter where I go, I get another family. And you know what's really neat? I get to pick them. Right? They're not assigned. So even if we don't get along, we can get along, you know? We have the right to our opinions and our statements and to be who we are and to accept each other for that and nothing else. You know, we can agree to disagree, which is such a wonderful thing for me. Because before that happened, I knew what was right. There was no way you could tell me any different. And, you know, that's a hard lesson to get over when I was first sober. Trying to manipulate, trying to control, trying to tell you what you needed when I didn't even know what the hell I needed. And by the grace of this program and the women that I have come to know in this program, I have learned a lot, an awful lot. And I've learned to love people because they're just people. And even if I don't like you, that's fine. I don't have to. But I do have to put out my hand and I do have to help you if I can. And I will. And I will. You know, that's what this program says. And I know that if people hadn't done that for me, I wouldn't be standing here right now talking to any of you. Because I was destined to be that good-looking corpse. My mom even agreed with that. I remember when I was a kid, I said to my mom, I said, I'm probably going to die young. And she said, yeah, you probably will. That was a heartbreaker. She agreed with me. Holy crap. You know you're in trouble when your mom agrees with something like that. And I continued on my path anyway. I did what I did anyway. And as far as the things that I did that were wrong, hell, you know what I did to what was wrong. You've been there. You've done it. You know my story. You all know my story. You all know what that big hole in your heart is about, that big empty black space that sits there. And no matter what you pour in it, it doesn't get filled. Money, men, women, booze, doesn't get filled. And when it starts to fill up, it's almost like you're going into shock because you don't know what that was like. You never had that. You didn't feel that. Sometimes you didn't feel anything. And then all of a sudden they go, well, you got feelings. And I'm like, oh, wonderful. Now what do you do? Right? You know? And the only feelings I had were fear and anger. My two tops. Fear and anger. You know? And I wasn't going to show you either. Well, I'd show you my anger quite readily, but I would not show you my fear. But I ate it. I lived on it. And I had no idea I was doing that. But today, by the grace of God, and like I said, everything that I've come to learn, that hole is pretty well filled. Most of the time, it's almost overflowing. Because life has turned out to be pretty decent. It's not great. It's not meant to be great. But it's good. And that's enough for me. I finally have got enough. And that's another thing I never thought I would have. I never thought I would have enough. But I do now. You know, most of the people that I had to make amends to were very accepting of my amends. I was lucky. I was real lucky. And then there were a couple that didn't. And I still miss them. I still miss those folks. But you know what? Once again, it goes right back to doing the best you can with what you've got. And that's all you can do. And, you know, this program is really like a matter of perception. I mean, I remember thinking maybe I'm a drug addict, but I'm not a drunk because my father was a drunk. So I'm not like my father. And when I went into the program, this guy told me to close my eyes, and he said, okay, well, when you sit down to party, what do you do? And I closed my eyes, and I said, well, I pull out a bottle of wine, and then I stopped talking. Because the first thing I always did was booze. And when I look back, it was always booze. It's where it started, and it's where it continued to keep going. And it would have continued on if I hadn't changed. So, you know, it was a matter of perception. It's kind of like these two kids, and they go in the hospital, and one's 5 and one's 6, and they're talking, and the little kid says to the other guy, he goes, well, what are you in for? He goes, oh, he says, well, I'm going to get my tonsils out. And he goes, oh, okay. And he goes, why, what are you here for? And he says, well, he says, I'm going to get, oh, God, you know, this. I'm old, so here goes my word. I'm going to get circumcised. And the kid looks at him and he goes, oh, no. And the guy goes, why? What's wrong? And he goes, they did that to me when I was a baby and I didn't walk for a year. So it's always a matter of perception as to how things are going to be and how things are. And my perception today is that things are pretty decent. They want me to talk for 40 minutes. If you're asleep, wake up. But the other thing I can tell you is, I'm not sure why I am still sober. I feel so often I shouldn't be. Because what's natural for me is to drink, not to be sober. And through all the things I've lived through, I should have drank. When my son died, I should have drank. I never felt pain like that in my whole life. When I lost my mom, I thought the same thing. I remember saying when I got sober that if any of these things happen, I'm going to get drunk. I'm just going to have to. And, you know, by the grace of God, I didn't. And that's a real blessing. When I was a kid, I said I was going to travel around the world. I finally did that about a year ago. I finally made it. And the funny thing about finishing a bucket list is that you suddenly realize you have one. And there's a couple other things on that bucket list that I'd like to do. And I'm working my way towards it. And one of them is I'd love to live to be sober long enough to meet God on my feet and not on my knees. And I want to be a member of this club that I never thought I'd join till I die. You know, I want that to happen if I can do it. Because there's so many yets for me. There's so many. And I'm really hoping that they go the other way. That's what I'm hoping for. Today is great. I'm that old lady with 8 dogs, 2 cats, and a tortoise. And I get up every day, and I walk these dogs. And I walk with these 2 people that I love. Sometimes there's 3 or 4 of us. And the other day we were talking, and we were talking about how dogs resemble people, their owners kind of thing. My friend said, well, you got 8. And I said, well, yeah, it's kind of hard to figure out which one, huh? And they said, oh, no, it's Stitch. And I said, Stitch? Stitch is this little white chihuahua that I found in the gutter in the rain and I brought home. And he is as arrogant and as sassy and as bold as they come. Oh, my God, I'm like Stitch. And I thought, you know, I am like Stitch. You know, I am. I'm tenacious. If I grab a hold of a bone, I'm going to hold on to it till it works. And I'm going to hold on to this program until it works. All the way through. Every day of my life. To the best of my ability. And if you don't want to stay here, that's fine. I mean, they tell you, well, glad to be fun your misery. You know, you want to go out and do it again? Go do it again. From all I've seen and heard, it's not a good deal. I don't really want to have those arrows in my butt. Because I don't want to have that pain. When I walked in here, I don't know about you guys, but my eyelashes flipping hurt. My whole body ached. You know, there was pain in every single day. I lost my best friend. I lost my lover. I lost my Bob. It was that simple. Everything was gone that I knew. I didn't know how to live like other people live. I knew to keep a job because a job provided for everything I wanted to do. That's the only thing I knew to do. Of course, my boss always used to say he could never figure out why before lunch I was great and then after lunch I was useless. Okay. We never discussed that in detail, thank goodness. You know, I've come back to be a good employee. I've come back to be a good mother. I've come back to be a good daughter. And I'm thankful that I had the time in my life to come back and do that. Before my mom died, well, you talk about two cats that fought most of their lives. I had the gift of telling her I was sorry for what I had done. She's about 4 feet tall. She's about this high. And I remember she was gardening. She had the most beautiful yard. And she stood up and she looked right at me. And then suddenly she looked up and she said, "Thank you, Jesus. I never thought I'd hear that." And I said, "I mean it." She goes, "I know you do." And she cried. You know? And she cried. So she became my best friend before I lost her to Alzheimer's. She became my very best friend. And I got to know who she was as a person. And I got to know the pain that happened to her in her life that I had never known. And maybe why she did some of the things she did. You know, and my daughter has come to know me in the same way. And she understands me in the same way. So, you know, if you work these steps, if you get to that point where you get to tell somebody, and you mean it, that you're sorry for the things you've done, then you're going to find out just how unconditional love really is. Because I wouldn't have put up with my crap for a minute. But I had a lot of people that loved me unconditionally. I have a higher power that loves me unconditionally. I have a stupid little white dog that loves me unconditionally. And I still have two brain cells that work enough that I can get up and speak. Thank goodness for that. I have a knee that's probably going to go south eventually, but other than that, it's good. So life is really wonderful today. It really, really is. And the last thing I'm going to say, and I'm going to probably cut this a little short, but there's a story, and I love this story, and it's about a little boy named Johnny. And Johnny was a good Catholic little kid, and he was raised in New York in the Bronx, and he would go to school every day. And right next to the school, there was this nice little chapel. So on his way to school, he would run up in the chapel in the front pew, and he would get down on his knees, and he would say, "Hi, God, this is Johnny, and I'm here." And the next day, he would be going to school, and he would run up into the chapel and say, "Hi, God, this is Johnny, and I'm here." And Johnny eventually got sick, and he got a fatal disease, and he was dying. So he came home, and he went to bed, and the doctor was called because he couldn't get up. And all of his buds came, and everybody was standing around his bed. And his mom was crying, of course, and his family was sad. And he was telling him, "Don't worry, it'll be okay." And so his mom goes, "How do you know?" And he goes, "I just know." And just before Johnny took his last breath, what he heard was, "Hi, Johnny, this is God, and I'm here. God loves you, and so do I. Thank you for your patience, and let me speak tonight."